From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, gerrymandering expert Dave Daly talks about the latest court rulings in redistricting cases around the country.
So here we are heading into the fourth election on these maps, and the Republican advantage that they achieved because of these victories back in 2010 and the lines that they drew in 2011 still endures.
Then photography, the American road trip, and how it speaks to the democratization of an art form.
You don't get accidental masterpieces in oil painting. You don't get accidental masterpieces in symphonic composition. But you do in photography. You really do.
We'll meet the choreographer and composer of one of the new dance pieces in Milwaukee Ballet's Milwaukee Mixed, an evening of contemporary dance.
And Radio Chipstone takes us to the ever-adapting Madison Central Library. Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. There have been several significant rulings recently in the continued fight over partisan gerrymandering in states around the country. The U.S. Supreme Court this week said it won't interfere with a ruling ordering Pennsylvania lawmakers to redraw congressional district maps, which state courts had found in violation of the law. But the court also stayed a North Carolina ruling, which will likely leave existing maps in place for the next elections. Meanwhile, the court is still considering a Wisconsin redistricting case, Gill v. Whitford.
Dave Daly has written extensively about the issue for the website Salon and in his most recent book, Rat-Effed. His recent reporting shows the history of a coordinated gerrymandering effort may go back farther than previously believed. Daly spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and talked about players in gerrymandering's modern history, starting with a man named Thomas Hoefler.
If you want to understand why in this 50-50 country that's so closely and deeply divided, Republicans have all the power in Washington and in more than two-thirds of all the state legislative chambers around the country, it's people like Tom Hoefler who were part of a plan called Red Map leading up to 2010 census and then the years after the 2010 census, and they were responsible for focusing the attention of the Republican Party on redistricting in 2010, and in a really focused and concerted state-by-state effort to make sure that when the maps were redrawn in every state, including Wisconsin, after that census, that it was Republicans who had every single seat at the table and that they had the best electoral strategy leading up to that election to make sure that they controlled all of these state chambers, and then that they had the best mapping and computer technology afterwards to draw lines on which Republicans have not lost yet this entire decade.
So, David, you wrote an entire book on this topic, but you recently realized that the timeline went a little further back than even you realized.
It's amazing. There has been so much litigation about these maps, not only in Wisconsin, of course, but in state after state, judges have taken a look at these maps and they've been outraged. And as a result, there has been all kinds of new evidence that's been subpoenaed and evidence that's come in through the discovery process. And what it shows is that the Republicans were working on this redistricting campaign before even the 2008 election. So early in 2008, they are already fundraising and asking their donors to contribute to an effort to win state legislative chambers so that the party can have an outsized influence over redistricting when the new lines are drawn after 2010. This is before the election of Barack Obama. This is going back very far. And it's really an unheard of concerted effort to be able to understand how important local elections can be. At this point in time, Democrats were really just focused on the presidency. They were thinking about winning and taking back the White House after two terms of George Bush. Republicans were already playing a longer game. They were looking ahead to the next decade and what that would look like and how they could create conservative governance in all of these states and how they could take expensive swing seats at the congressional level completely off the table, just wipe them off the map altogether, and they pulled it all off.
What kind of insight does this give us into the thinking of GOP leaders, both at that time and now, you know, a decade later?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really brilliant strategy. And what you saw even just last week was an Ohio congressman by the name of Steve Stivers, who is the head of the National Republican Campaign Committee, the organization responsible for keeping the House in Republican hands. And they asked him about 2018 and the prospects of a blue wave. And he kind of said, well, Democrats are looking good this year, but redistricting gave us a huge advantage. So here we are heading into the fourth election on these maps, and the Republican advantage that they achieved because of these victories back in 2010 and the lines that they drew in 2011 still endures. In 2012, which was the first election held on these maps, Democratic candidates nationwide get 1.4 million more votes than Republicans, and yet Republicans hold on to a 234-201 advantage in the U.S. House. If you take a look at five key swing states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, and North Carolina, they send collectively 49 Republicans and 20 Democrats to Washington. And not one of those seats has changed hands all decade. Democrats have not managed to flip a single seat blue in any of those swing states. So as we head towards 2018, there are lots of data journalists who are projecting a big Democratic wave. There are lots of generic congressional ballot polls showing that Democrats have an advantage. But if you look at the actual elections in every state so far on these maps, Democrats have had no luck at all. And that continues even in 2017 in Virginia. I mean, Democrats gained a key 15 states in the House of Delegates in Virginia, but they won a quarter of a million more votes than Republicans and still could not take back the chamber. Republicans are still in charge. So Democrats have a steep, steep wall to climb.
David, you know, this is kind of an aside. The Senate GOP recently tweeted a tribute video to Ronald Reagan where he says, "We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us." And as I watched it, I wondered to myself, does the practice of partisan gerrymandering really stand in opposition to that ideal and that concept?
I think you're exactly right. And the extra irony there is that in one of his farewell speeches, one of his final speeches, Ronald Reagan came out aggressively against the idea of partisan gerrymandering. He said, we've got to do something to fix this way back in the fall of 1988. So I think if Ronald Reagan was taking a look at what was happening right now, even he would be a little bit horrified about how the Republicans have managed to keep all of this control.
How are they able to maintain this populist narrative? That's part of what confuses me, because they have been very open about what they were trying to do with partisan gerrymandering, what they hoped to do and were able to do, and yet they maintain this populist narrative.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there have been, you know, lots of books, whether it's, you know, Tom Frank on What's the Matter with Kansas, or, you know, lots of folks who have, you know, tried to address this gap between sort of the populist face of the party and sort of the very different manner in which they govern. I would say that it becomes possible to do that when you feel like you are insulated from the voters. What you have seen in the last year is the U.S. House passed not only the Obamacare repeal, but also a tax bill, both of which in public opinion polling ranked among the least popular pieces of legislation in decades that had been considered by the U.S. House. And yet they passed them anyway, which makes you think that perhaps the donors are in charge and not the people, and it makes you think that perhaps the folks who are voting on these bills simply don't fear being voted out of office.
Have you heard an explanation from GOP leaders that explains why partisan gerrymandering might be good for democracy? Have there been arguments to that effect?
That's a great question. I mean, famously, there is a political scientist in Texas who has argued that, you know, partisan gerrymandering is good for democracy because it creates these polarized districts and you end up with a real debate of ideas in Washington because everybody feels as if they are a representative. He's written a book about this, and I'm trying to encapsulate his ideas as best I can here. I think essentially what he is saying is that when districts represent overwhelmingly the will of one group of people, more people get their will represented than they would if they were scattered. And I'm not sure that that line of thinking makes an awful lot of sense, but it does to the Trump administration, which has decided to make this man the deputy director of the U.S. Census in 2020. And the census, of course, is crucial to the next set of maps that will be drawn in 2021. So we may well have in charge of the census somebody who thinks partisan gerrymandering is terrific for America. I would say look around at what it has given us over the course of this last decade, the extreme polarization, the gridlock, and the dysfunction, and all of these states in which you have veto-proof supermajorities, even though the party gets a minority of votes. And I would say that the partisan gerrymandering has been a disaster for this country.
It seems like courts have largely agreed with you on that matter in states like North Carolina, Texas, and of course Wisconsin. But the federal Supreme Court has allowed these maps to stay in place for the time being. What has their rationale been?
It's been an amazing decade. These maps have taken a beating pretty much every single time they've come before judges. And you're right, in all of those states, there have been big wins for the forces against partisan gerrymandering. The U.S. Supreme Court, however, has never in our history articulated a standard that defines when a partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional and when it has gone too far. It now has two new chances. One of them, of course, is Gill versus Whitford from Wisconsin. The other case is Benisek versus Lamone, which is a partisan gerrymandering case out of Maryland, in which the Democrats squeezed an extra congressional district for themselves, turning a 6-2 Democratic map in Maryland into a 7-1 Democratic map. And those two cases are before the Supreme Court right now. We already know that there are four liberal justices who are interested in trying to solve this problem, and we know that there are four conservative justices who are pretty skeptical and not particularly interested in involving the court in what they've called the, quote, political thicket of redistricting. So the swing vote is Justice Kennedy, who has indicated that if he can see a clear and reasonable standard, if that can be articulated for him, that he would be interested in finding a remedy. So all indications are that if you look at the tea leaves out of the court, that the five of them are going to come up with some kind of remedy. Nobody quite knows exactly what it is or how far it will go, but it seems as if some of these most extreme toxic partisan gerrymanderings could be reined in by the next time this comes around. The North Carolina case, this is the first time ever that a lower federal court threw out an entire state congressional map on the grounds of it being an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. The court has stayed that ruling until it considers the Wisconsin and Maryland cases. We ought to have word on that probably in the spring after there's a ruling in Whitford and in Benisek. The Pennsylvania case is pretty interesting because it also involves the striking down of an entire congressional map four elections into this decade, but it's a state constitutional violation there. It was the state Supreme Court that threw those maps out. So the U.S. Supreme Court has declined to get involved. You may very well see new maps in Pennsylvania in 2018, and that means an awful lot, because Pennsylvania is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. There are 18 congressional districts there in this essentially blue swing state, and Republicans hold 13 of the 18 seats. So that's 71% of the seats, even though they routinely win less than 50% of the votes. If you turn that around, the Democrats get more than 50% of the votes and hold fewer than 30% of the seats. So there's a good chance for a handful of Democratic seats to be picked up this fall in Pennsylvania.
So we're expecting a decision on Whitford and Benesec coming out in spring. Does it seem plausible that the federal Supreme Court would require the redrawing of these maps before the 2018 election?
That feels pretty doubtful to me. The Supreme Court tends to hate forcing states to redraw maps in the middle of an election year, let alone 4 or 5 months outside of an election year. I would be very surprised if at a point in time when, you know, parties have nominated candidates, candidates have been raising money and campaigning in specific districts, if they then went ahead and tore it all up and mandated new maps. The danger of all of this is, though, is that it encourages politicians to simply try to run out the process. So it could well be that these maps in Maryland and also in Wisconsin, as well as North Carolina, are proven unconstitutional, but they've survived for 8 out of 10 years of a decade. Once again, I would say that that's pretty dangerous for the idea of democracy.
Regardless of what happens in the courts, what are we seeing at the state level? I know in Wisconsin, we've had this fair maps resolution. More than 2/3 of voters feel we should have legislation creating a nonpartisan agency. Have we seen that in other states?
It's amazing. There has been an outpouring of citizen activism in state after state across the country. I mean, my publisher made me give this book a vulgar title because they did not think that people knew what gerrymandering was, or if they did, they thought it bored them and it would make their eyes glaze over. What we have actually seen, though, now are hundreds of thousands of people signing petitions in Ohio, in Michigan, in Virginia, in North Carolina to end partisan gerrymandering, to force truly democratic solutions, to bring independent commissions into play, to be thinking about new ways of drawing these districts that actually enhance, you know, fair representation. It has been wonderful to see. I mean, in Michigan, 400,000 people have signed a petition that started with a frustrated young person's post on Facebook the day after the 2016 election. This has turned into a real movement there called Voters Not Politicians. In Ohio, where these lines were drawn in what the politicians themselves called the bunker, a secret suite at the DoubleTree Hotel in Columbus, Ohio, where they hid out and drew these lines in private. What you have seen is 250,000 people signing petitions. And just this week, politicians in Ohio essentially threw up a white flag and they said, okay, we will fix redistricting here. They were so afraid of the idea of a constitutional amendment that they worked together with reformers to fix this system. So when people get involved, they can do amazing things, even with an issue that seems as esoteric and technical as gerrymandering. Really, it is at the root of our democracy. These lines are the building blocks of our democracy. And when they get corrupted and twisted, it twists the essence of fairness.
David Daly, thank you so much for speaking with me today once again. I look forward to hearing more from you.
A pleasure. Absolutely anytime. Thank you so much.
Dave Daly is a senior fellow for Fair Vote and the author of Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. He spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find coverage of Wisconsin's gerrymandering case before the U.S. Supreme Court at WUWM.com.
As you think longingly about your summer road trips past and future, a new exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum may inspire how you chronicle your next time on the road. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Americans have been fond of the road trip for a very long time, since there were roads, frankly. But there was a time when to see pictures of your friends' road trips, you had to sit in their den or basement rec room and watch a slideshow or flip through a photo album.
Of course, today we see our friends' photos 24 hours a day on their social media feeds. And what counts as a road trip could be a trip to the Grand Canyon or even a quick dash to the 7-Eleven. Well, an exhibit that recently opened at the Milwaukee Art Museum offers viewers a chance to see how the great American road trip was envisioned and captured by some great photographers, both American and from overseas. Here's Ariel Pate, the assistant photography curator at the Art Museum, explaining why she thought it was important to bring the exhibit to Milwaukee.
I had a chance to visit the exhibit just before it opened and spoke with David Campany, a London-based photography writer and co-curator of the Open Road exhibit. Denise Wolfe is the other co-curator. She's based at New York's Aperture Foundation, and she started by explaining what attracted her to the idea of this exhibit.
Growing up here, I made road trips as a kid, and even by myself and with friends. And so for me, it was always this kind of way of seeing America and getting out of your familiarity and kind of experiencing both yourself, a kind of self-discovery trip, and also seeing different places of America. And it just struck me as that if you have a car, you have a certain sense of freedom, at least freedom of mobility. Certainly I did. And so that was the heart of why I wanted to do this. And also I just noticed many, many photographers, some of the best work in the history of photography was made on American roads. And so it was also this sense of like, this should be collected together. Let's look at it. And here it is.
I was struck by the fact that even if you're not looking at road trips and you're just looking at American photography, it's surprising how much of the very best American photography happened to be made on road trips. And that was the way I thought about it. So rather than thinking, ah, yes, there's a road trip, it becomes a sort of photographic genre. People start to do it a lot, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. I went the other way around and just said, why is it that so much of the best American photography happened to be made on the road? And the book goes right back to the very beginning of motoring, picking up at the beginning of the 20th century. But the image section of the book, which is really the heart of the book, begins with Robert Frank, who's a Swiss photographer who came to America in the 40s, late 40s, and in the mid-50s gets a grant, a Guggenheim grant, to go on the road, and he spends about 18 months on the road. And it's an outsider's view of America, and maybe Americans forget the reputation of America, particularly in the first half of the 20th century worldwide, was extraordinary for its culture, for its industry, for its ambition, its sense of purpose. And many, many photographers wanted to come and wanted to see it. Frank fell in love with it, but he also found it alienating and difficult and melancholy. And he ended up making a book, which he called The Americans. And that really set the flame. So many other photographers saw that book that the exhibition we decided would begin with Robert Frank. And it carries forward, and you notice the motifs are the same, and yet they change. Every photographer has their own inflection, their own way of doing it. There's not one way to make a road trip. Some made just one, maybe across country. Some spent several years on the road and really kind of crisscrossed. And it goes all the way from Frank in the mid-50s right up to the 2000s.
Why is the road trip such a quintessentially American phenomenon as opposed to a European phenomenon or anywhere else? What makes this, what made European photographers want to come to the United States to do this versus driving across France and Switzerland and Austria?
I think that our country is so huge, and it's connected. It was first connected by railroad, which was a kind of communal sort of transportation, but then the car made it much more about the individual freedom and the person just taking off and leaving. But I think that's the ultimate way of seeing America. People come here and they want to get in the car and be pulled west.
There's something in the American psyche, which I never know if it's obvious to Americans, but it's very obvious to outsiders like me, is that clearly the country was an experiment. You know, it was a restart. It wanted to do things unlike Europe in lots of ways. And I think the best American sensibility still sees the country and its culture as a project, a kind of ongoing project. And so photographers are very good at taking the temperature of that project, of sort of monitoring it. And so there are elements of the show which are quite critical, where the photographers are quite surprised at what they see. But there's also an enormous affection and fascination for what the place looks like, what people look like, what it is to move through a country of that size. I mean, there are only a few shots in the show that are literally taken from the car, but many of the photographers talk about that extraordinary state you're in when you drive. You know, it's almost meditative. You stop the car, you feel the crunch of gravel or sidewalk under your feet when you get out. And because you've been in the car, you're suddenly very, very attuned to what you're looking at. The air, the space, the way you're moving through the space, the way people are moving around you.
I like the light, of course. Joel Meyerowitz says, and I think it's the quote back here, that he thinks of the car almost like a camera. And when he's moving through it, these images are going by. That's such a great way of thinking about it. And that feels like that meditative state. Even if you're not taking pictures, it can feel that way. Actually, I was really struck this time going through it, and maybe we put this together in 2012, 2013, so a lot of time has passed. But this sense of motion in America and progress, like we're always, what David was saying, that we're a country that's always trying to remake itself. But it's interesting bumping up against photography, because photography is still, and often what's said about photography is that it has a memorializing function. It captures something of this moment and makes it permanent, or you know, makes it something you can look back on and remember. And so it's a really interesting conflict that's going on in the show, and in tension within these works. That may be the heart of why so much of the great American photography is on the road, is because there is that sense of motion and the metaphor for progress in America, but it's being captured by a still medium. So that, for me, that resonates huge right now at this moment.
It's interesting, as you're describing this, the idea keeps coming back to mind. This for European photographers to come here and do this is almost the photographic equivalent of what de Tocqueville did with American politics in the early 18th century.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're quite right about that. And interestingly, when Robert Frank first published The Americans in 1958, it was published first in France, Les Américains, and opposite his pictures, the publisher placed lots of quotations, writers talking about America, and de Tocqueville is one of those. When the book gets published the next year in America, those quotations disappear, and Jack Kerouac does the introduction, and it's pitched very much as a kind of beat project. In many ways, it's lived on beyond that kind of beat culture sensibility.
How does the phenomenon of road trip photography relate to the phenomenon of street photography?
I think there's something about moving through the world and the photographer as a sort of a hunter. That sounds quite sinister. All I mean by that is a photographer who's thinking speculatively. They don't know what it is they want. And something comes up, something catches their eye, and you have to be quick. And it's exhausting work. It's interesting. Robert Frank was, I was watching a recent documentary, and the director of the documentary says to Robert Frank, what are your memories of making those pictures over that 18-month period? And he's in his late 80s now, and he sighs and he scratches his head and he said, well, I was in really good shape back then. And that's an interesting remark, because to do street photography, and it does overlap with road trip photography, to do it really well is exhausting. It really takes a lot out of your nervous system. You have to be permanently alert. You're making your pictorial judgments really quickly. You're thinking about what the picture, you know, is as a fact, and what it is as a kind of metaphor or as a symbol or as a piece of poetry. And you're doing that very, very, very fast.
I think also with street, you get the sense in looking at it and in talking to street photographers that these intersections of people in particular places, that's happening right then and never again. So there's this magic moment that happens in the picture. And something I've heard the different photographers talk about with the road photography, it's a different feeling, but this idea that if you see something, you gotta stop that car right then, because you're never going to go back to it. And if you do, it will never look the same. So they're capturing a certain time, their time, right at that moment.
I feel like we should look at some of the pictures that are emblematic of what you're talking about.
Oh, well, let's look at this one. This is Robert Frank's trolley car taken in New Orleans in 1955. And it's a side-on view of a trolley car. It's a beautiful shot where he's kind of framed this sort of informal portrait, group portrait, but in a way you suddenly realize it's not a group portrait. The African-American faces are at the back of the trolley car. All the windows are divided. Nobody's really recognizing each other's presence. They're all together in the frame. They're all together on the trolley bus, but really, you know, it's a picture of an incohesive society. But the picture's also full of, you know, affection and commitment to describe what's in front of you. Something of an icon now, this photograph.
Almost as though these are individual viewfinders. It's almost like a negative strip.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at the top of the frame here, it really does look like 35mm frames. And then there are square format frames of the windows.
I love how they aren't socializing at all or connected at all with each other, but they're all connecting with the photographer in various ways.
Well, and in a way, he's kind of showing America to itself.
Yeah. It's very true. I mean, it's still an incredibly resonant photograph, this one.
Some other images that people should be sure to take note of when they come?
We have images by Stephen Shaw from a project he made over 6 or 7 years in the 1970s called Uncommon Places. Shaw has a big retrospective at the moment at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And he was a New Yorker. He didn't even, you know, most New Yorkers don't even have a car. Most New Yorkers don't even think of themselves as belonging to America in the broadest sense. It's like a sort of honorary European city in a way. And of course, if you think about that Simon and Garfunkel song, America,
right.
Walked off to look for America, well, they're New Yorkers. And there's that sense that America is out there somewhere. And in fact, most Americans have that sense that they're not quite in America. You have to go somewhere else to find it. You have to go somewhere else to experience it. And Stephen Shaw left New York in the early 70s. He had friends living in Amarillo, Texas. He learned to drive. He got himself a car, and he spent an awful lot of time on the road, mainly working with an 8x10 camera. So the negative you're making is 8x10 inches. That's a lot of detail. You can't make snapshots. It's very slow work, very studied work. But they're absolutely everyday scenes. Typical streets. He's not really shooting in the big major cities, the kind of secondary cities and smaller towns. But there's just an extraordinary attention to the sense of place and the sense of light. You know, he can even make a picture of his pancakes in the morning and his melon, you know, a kind of compelling thing.
Do you think all of us are trying to do that in some way? I mean, the proliferation of camera phones and, you know, the...
Well, it's interesting. Stephen Shaw is a big hero on Instagram. So he's often thought of as a highly serious photographer, and he is, and he takes Instagram as seriously as anything else. I think the proliferation of images is, I think the idea of that is a bit of a distraction, because you can go back to the 1920s and people are complaining about there being too many images. But it raises the question of, well, what's not too many? What's the correct number of images there should be in the world? If you don't like them, don't look. I mean, people often talk about, you know, we're bombarded by images these days. And I think, really? Are they coming to get you? Well, maybe there are algorithms now that do target images, particularly to do with consumption. But I think against that, there has always been a very serious and very enthusiastic kind of photography that just wants to examine what's out there. And the interesting thing about photography is there is a democracy of talent. There is nothing to stop anyone going out and making something extraordinary. They may not be able to make 200 of them, but you don't get accidental masterpieces in oil painting. You don't get accidental masterpieces in symphonic composition, but you do in photography. You really do. And a lot of these photographers are working in a, although they're better at it and more considered, they're making pictures of the kind that anyone could make. You know, they really are. They're just doing it better.
Well, this is all just wonderful stuff. I thank you so much for sharing it with me and with the world.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
The Open Road, Photography and the American Road Trip is on display through April 22nd at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We spoke with co-curators David Campany, who wrote the book that accompanies the exhibit, and Denise Wolfe. You can see several of the photographs from the exhibit at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll chat with Milwaukee Ballet choreographer Nicole Teague-Howell and local composer Luxy about their collaboration in this week's Milwaukee Ballet production at the Pabst. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. That soundscape was composed especially for a work premiering tonight at the Pabst Theater. The piece, called Pull, was choreographed by Milwaukee Ballet leading artist Nicole Teague-Howell. The composer is MIAD grad and Milwaukee-based artist Luxy. Their collaboration is one part of an evening of new dances presented by the ballet called Milwaukee Mixed.
Teague-Howell and Luxy joined me in the studio recently to talk about their process, and Teague-Howell explains the idea behind the entire production.
Going into this production at the Pabst with Milwaukee Ballet, we've been given the opportunity to work with local musicians. That was the whole idea behind Made in Milwaukee, Milwaukee Mixed.
So what was it about her music that appealed to you?
It was the feeling I got listening to it. She expresses herself, I feel, through her sound, and I thought it would be the perfect thing to put movement to. I saw movement immediately. That was really important to me.
Luxy, were you surprised when she approached you? Have you ever had any of your music choreographed to before?
I have not, actually, and I was surprised, very much so, to see her name pop up in my email and hear about the project and everything, but it was really just an amazing opportunity, so I definitely jumped on that, and we met a couple times, and I got really good vibes from Nicole, and thought we would work together really well, and I was just super happy to be part of the collaboration with the Milwaukee Ballet.
Now, you have composed music for your own work before, because you're a MIAD grad,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
And so you've done that multimedia thing. What was
Definitely.
Different this time, working with a choreographer and then with dancers on stage?
I guess I would say the main difference is at some point you have to give up control of your artwork and kind of trust someone to take it to the next place. And I definitely trusted Nicole to choreograph something amazing to it, and she definitely has. Yeah, it was just really an amazing process.
Did you find that you had to change anything? And when you two would be working on things, did you ever come to her, Nicole, and say, you know what, I need something slightly different here. Can you do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
And that was okay.
Happened.
That was a fine.
Yeah, definitely. I knew that inevitably there were going to be changes, especially with working in live theater and with dancers. There was going to be so much that was necessary for the timing to be just right. So it was mostly timing things that we worked on, like speeding things up or slowing them down, and creating dynamics. So there's some moments that drop down to almost silence with just breathing. And some moments that are really big, like finale style. And yeah, so it was all sorts of different things.
Well, what's really interesting to me is that the kind of music that you create is multi-layered as well. You've got voice, you've got synthesized sounds, you've got all kinds of things layered on top of each other. It's not necessarily like an orchestral piece that maybe a more traditional ballet, although those are layered too, but the sounds tend to be much more traditional, if to use that word. And so to find those layers and then to be layering the actual movement on top of that must have been a really interesting process.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's been fantastic. And that's what this production is about. You know, it's not necessarily traditional or what you'd expect or anything you've seen before.
Can you give us more of a hint than that? I mean, is it a different movement vocabulary?
It is, yeah. I mean, as a choreographer, each choreographer has different movement vocabulary. I, being a classical ballet-trained dancer, obviously come from that classical tradition, and moving into contemporary work is something that everybody has to do in this profession at this level.
When you do that, are you taking the vocabulary of ballet and then stretching it, of traditional ballet, you know, for those of us who have no experience with
that? Yeah, you could call it that. It's kind of why I chose the name pole for my piece, because classical ballet pulls your body in different directions, and when you just mold your dancers to express different things through their body, you get different movements.
But you have a different name for the piece of music, right?
Yeah.
It's not Pull. What is it?
It's All I Wanted, and it's featuring an old friend of mine and colleague. His name is Todd Umhofer, so I had him do the male vocals on the track. But yeah, it's kind of natural that they have two different names, because I feel like they're almost their own things. Also, like, I plan on releasing the audio by itself as an EP that's just a 15-minute long track. After the performances are done, and so I'll probably name it All I Wanted. And then, yeah, seeing Nicole's piece, Pull, it definitely has that feeling, and I think it definitely crosses over with the lyrics and the song, and just with the movement of the dancers itself.
So is this a collaboration that you two would like to recreate at some point, doing some other pieces?
Yeah,
I would love to.
It's been awesome.
So do you find that you feed off each other?
Definitely. I definitely feed off of her music. And from the moment we met, we talked about creating something, you know, from scratch. And
yeah, definitely.
It was very collaborative.
I think it worked out perfectly with getting paired together. And well, you selected me, but I think it was definitely a good choice.
And so what would you like to do if you know, once this is done, what kinds of things do you see yourselves working on together in the future?
Well, this has been an amazing opportunity for myself and this company with the direction of Michael Pink, what he's been able to give us as dancers, this newfound freedom to become something else, to grow as a dancer, as a person, as a choreographer. So, I mean, if I ever had this opportunity again, I would love to work with Lexi, and we could make something almost completely different.
Yeah, I feel like we're both, like, not scared to go outside the box, so we could really push, like, the boundaries in that area for sure.
Well, you know, Nicole, if you ever start your own company, you have a built-in composer.
Definitely.
I guess that's how it works. You meet people.
And you create something. I mean, if it works together, why not? You know, when you
I'd
think
be down
about
for
it.
That.
Yeah. And so once this, I mean, Nicole, obviously you're part of the company and you'll continue working with Milwaukee Ballet. Lexi, what's next for you?
Well, I'm currently undertaking a new project. I kind of try and do one big thing a year creatively. So aside from the Milwaukee Ballet track, which I actually finished in December, I'm moving on to a more multimedia kind of base style of working. So I'm actually teaching myself video game design, and I'm working in 3D kind of interactive exploratory kind of games, if you will, but they're more like interactive music videos. So I'm kind of trying to branch out in technology, kind of explore different things going on with that.
Well, ladies, I want to thank you both for coming in and telling us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Milwaukee Ballet lead artist Nicole Teague Howell choreographed Pull, set to an original composition by Milwaukee-based multimedia artist Luxy.
Their piece is one of five premiering at the Pabst Theater tonight in a Milwaukee Ballet program called Milwaukee Mixed. The ballet's annual production of contemporary dance runs through Sunday, and there's more information at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then Radio Chipstone takes us to the ever-adapting Madison Central Library. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Built in 1965, Madison Central Library couldn't imagine the challenges of the digital world. So in 2012, it shut down for 2 years. It then reemerged as something that looks like a cross between a museum, a student lounge, and a coffee house. It's designed to anticipate change and the needs of the community.
Tana Elias is the digital services and marketing manager there. She says the new library is a living space that the community was instrumental in creating. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Elias tells contributor Jennifer Fields that while the space is new, they also wanted to make sure they maintained old relationships.
What we're finding with all of the different audiences that we serve is they all want space. So we tried to redesign this library in particular to take advantage of all the natural light on the outside of the building, put the books in the back where they wouldn't have as much exposure to the sun, but also really just knowing that people want space to collaborate. When we did our planning meetings, we heard over and over the business community wanted space to collaborate. The people who go to the homeless shelters during the evening wanted space to hang out and feel safe and comfortable. So we're really meeting a variety of different needs with our space and with our services and programs. What we did in this library is we invited a lot of different social service agencies in, and this was a safer space. So the services exist elsewhere in the community, but we brought them all together under one roof where people also had access to the internet and had space to sit during the day, had a comfortable place to be, and were able to provide services for people in this space in a way that felt more comfortable, is what we've been hearing.
So Tana, this is really a surprise. Tell me about what we're standing in front of.
So this is a sculpture built into the wall of the library, and it's called Library Stack by Heath Matisik Snyder. He was a local artist at the time that this was commissioned, and this is one piece where we invited artists from the community to submit proposals, and we really wanted art to be an important part of this building. What he did here is he took some of the old furniture from our 1965 library and some of the books and materials from that space and then built a sculpture around it. And it's a piece that you can sit on. It's actually a piece that holds a time capsule. There's a desk right here in the wall, and if you were to take it out of the wood that's holding it in, inside the drawer is a time capsule from when we opened the building.
But there's something else here that's kind of funny. There's a fire alarm right in the middle of all this wood.
Yeah, so the stack was kind of a play on words, call books on shelves, stacks. And what he did was to stack a whole bunch of wood up to the ceiling. And then right in the middle, which we didn't intend but makes it especially funny, is there is a fire alarm right in the middle of the wood at the top. I was here through the transition when we closed our central library, and we had moved out into a variety of different spaces temporarily for almost 2 years. And then we came back, and it kind of did feel like a trial by fire in some ways. We really had to reimagine everything from how we move the books through the building to what kinds of programs and services we provide.
Standing right here 10 years ago, could you have imagined that you'd be standing in this structure. It's an atrium.
It is.
Right now.
I think the biggest difference for me is the feeling of constant change. What we had in our old library was maybe not regimented, but very set. You know, the furniture was set, and it was set in such a way that it didn't move around the building. And the kinds of programs that we had were people coming in and sitting and listening to things. Even our story times for kids were more sitting and listening versus the kinds of story times that we have now that incorporate music and yoga and lots of action and art. And really just, I feel like the new space just has a lot more energy. It's okay to be loud. It's okay to be artistic. It's okay to bring your coffee. It's okay to talk to other people in this space. And it's okay to ask any question, and you'll still get an answer. So as some things change, some things are still the same as well.
I think of institutions, whether they're leader-based, where you go to them and they tell you what to do, they tell you how to behave. Like you said, the library previously used to be very regimented. It felt like a space where I had to adjust to the space in the sense of I could not be my authentic self, as they say now. Whereas this library seems to be more on the service base. We're here, we're asking you what you need, and we're providing that. Was that a conscious flip when you guys did that, or am I just way off the base here?
Very much so. One program that we've done last year and we'll be doing again this year is called Library Takeover. And what we did in that instance was, rather than just put on a program, we worked with groups. We had an application process. They applied to run a program at the library. We taught them how to run a program, anything from marketing to financial planning to whatever it is that they needed to do. We gave them a budget, and then we gave them free rein. We had a space for them. We were at their disposal to kind of help them through that planning process. And we got some amazing events out of that. And none of those were events that we would have planned on our own. And they all brought different audiences to the library, many for the first time. So really working with community leaders and people in the community and giving them the tools and the spaces and the assistance that they need to do their own projects is the model that we've consciously chose to work off of in the last 5 years. You know, we've really seen a change in the last 5 years, and some of that was having a new director. Some of it was the opportunity of having a new space and really kind of thinking creatively. Being in the media for the year that we were closed and then reopening really allowed us to kind of make new connections in the community. That visibility of opening a large library downtown really opened the doors for a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. Even things like working with a bubbler in the teaching, the artist in residence program. We're teaching artists how to teach about art. They might be very accomplished artists on their own, but they're maybe haven't had the experience of teaching. And so working with artists and other people in the community to kind of help them do the work that they're doing better or reach new audiences has been something that's been really rewarding, I think, in all of our programming.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. That project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Fields spoke with Tana Elias, digital services and marketing manager for the Madison Public Library. Radio Chipstone wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.